Lectionary Lab Live is recorded by Two Bubbas and a Bible live from Gainesville, Florida and Brasstown, North Carolina. Welcome, everybody, to the Lectionary Lab Live. I'm John Fairless. I'm here with my Bubba, Delmer Chilton. Say hey, Bubba.
Hey, Bubba.
Hey, man. Good to get with you this week. It's hot.
Yeah. Well, it's not. It's been unseasonably not hot. I wouldn't call it cool in Western North Carolina, but it's not as hot as it often is.
Of living in the mountains versus on the Gulf Coast, then.
Yeah, that'll do it.
We're heat index over 100 every day. It's hot and humid. And, you know, I moved to Florida. I knew what the deal was. So, not complaining, but all of that to say it's good to get up with you today. We're going to talk some texts for the fifth Sunday now after Pentecost. These are the texts for July the 5th, 2020. I think everybody's probably rocking along with us in our rhythm right now. And so we've got another great Genesis story following that semi-continuous track. And you're going to have some comments on the gospel passage. This is one you know well, as you were telling me before the show, and all the other good stuff we got in front of us. So tell me what's on your mind today, Bubba.
Well, you know, this is July 5th. That's Independence Day weekend, 4th of July weekend. So I want to say, with the issue of patriotism slash the current climate slash election year, et cetera, fans of Lost in Space will know what I'm about to say. Danger, Will Robinson. Danger.
Go the other way. Go the other way. Don't do it.
Don't go that way. Yeah. I just have to say, first of all, there's almost nothing in these texts you could build a 4th of July sermon about. I played with it a little bit, and I think the Romans, the ambiguity of the human situation, that's not really a patriotic text. That's kind of like we're Americans, and we're on all over the place for disagreements, and you can play a little bit with that with the gospel, but really, if you're going to do something along those lines, you're probably going to have to get outside the lectionary to do it authentically. Mm-hmm. That's just my take.
As for me, in my house, during the announcements, I'm going to say, happy birthday, America. What a great privilege to live here. And, you know, let's thank God and pray for our country. And then I'm going to move on. And the text is going to drive
most me. Most denominational hymnals have a section of, hymns that are kind of in my country, 'tis of thee, or whatever, you know, and God bless America or something. Sing a hymn, whatever. Pray for the United States, which I do every week anyway.
Correct.
But I just don't, like I say, if you need to do that, there's not a lot in these texts to do that with. So, as I said, the second thing on my mind this week is that one of the great texts for this week is, the Romans text on the ambiguity of the human situation ambiguity. Yeah. And so I'm going to spend some time there. And then of course you got that wonderful Genesis and Psalm story, which on the surface, is a Hallmark Hall of Fame love channel story. I mean, can't you just see a plot developed out of this whole thing?
I'm going to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah,
in keeping with the sermon series I've been building. But one of the points is this is just a great love story. It's tucked in, and we don't pay much attention to it, but it really is.
But you know, underneath that is the whole notion of God's involvement in our lives. You know, and the providence of God continuing that promise from Abraham. And this is a signal that God is continuing that promise to Abraham and Sarah about a child, but then continuing involvement with Isaac as he continues to build that chosen people, that progeny that he has promised to Abraham, mm-hmm. which leads us to think about the question. And this is sort of my segue. So this, one of the underlying things to think about as you look at this, is God involved in our personal, in our lives? And do we see God's activity there? And what is the balance between a faith that's based on seeing God deeply involved in the individual things of our lives, and with the other side of that is the real focus to be do we involve our lives in the will and way of God?
In the life of God, yes. Yeah, I think that's a great way to look at it.
Sometimes, and that question that people say, what did I ever do to deserve this, is the downside of this, as though bad things happening to us is a sign that God's mad at us. And the other side is the people who say, when you say, I've asked them how they are, they'll say, I've been blessed. And then they start talking about material things they've received as if that's a sign that, and neither of those extremes is indicative of a relationship with God.
Yeah.
It's more complex than that. So that's what this story provokes a little bit for me. I'm going to run through quickly a little basic plot stuff, and then you do your thing, because you're preaching a series on this. You got to remember there's a backstory in which Abraham sent for a servant and told him to go find Isaac a wife from his own kindred, his own people. And the sign would be, you know, ask for a drink and, you know, she'll do that. And so we pick up the story after the event.
Right.
After it's happened. And after that, actually, he went to the oasis, and he's sitting there, and he sees this woman, and he asks her for a drink. She gives him the drink and the camels and all that. You will hear that. So she says, you got to go. And her people are her brother Laban and the other brothers. And so the first part of this text, 34 down through about 49, is essentially a retelling of what just happened.
Yeah. And you can kind of thank the committee and thank God that, because it's really the same story repeated twice. It's told when it happens to the servant named Eliezer in another part of the text.
Yep.
And then when he comes, he retells the whole thing. And
right.
You don't have to listen to it twice. Yeah.
And then the second part of the text, and it skips some verses there. Second part of the text is they called Rebecca in. She was not present while they're talking about this. He basically says, so you want to go? She says, yep. She's willing to do this. Mm-hmm. I'll do it. Then the last part of the text, the verses 62 through 67, is the real love story part. And I just love the part where she sees Isaac coming and she says, who's that?
Who's that man?
You know, it's like in modern day, she'd be in the bar looking down the bar and say, who's that guy?
Yeah.
Oh, that's my master. She said, all righty then.
Yeah. As you talked about once upon a time, they had eyes for each other.
Eyes for each other. And so they go, and I love the kind of in 67, that last little setting, you know, takes her into the tent. This is the wedding, you know, this is the consummation of this arrangement. And it's really interesting. He took Rebecca, she became his wife, and he loved her.
It is the only place in this whole series of patriarchs and their wives and concubines and so on, and we have a lot of that if you're reading all the way through Genesis. This is the only place in any of those stories where the text comments, and he loved her.
Right.
Everybody else, there may be love, there may be lots of things, but it's mostly beauty and arrangements and so on and so forth. So, yeah, it's a great moment to notice.
The last half of that text is very, very emotional. Not emotional is not what I'm getting at. It's very, very feeling-oriented and not different than emotional, because it talks about he loved her and he was comforted.
Yeah, after his mom died.
We usually don't hear in Genesis those kind of things expressed that way. Yep. So there's the basic story, and as I said, on a deeper level, you look at that and you think, particularly that whole "give me a sign," you know, and the sign being fulfilled. That whole sense that the Hebrew scriptures have of God's involvement in the daily, what happens in our daily lives. And it becomes for us a question, how much of that it matters, and how does that, how do we see that, and how is God involved in our lives?
Right.
And how much does God, our sense of God's involvement in our daily lives generates faith, and how much of that do we need to hold on to faith? Because there's another side of it, of long absences of God, of not feeling God there, and people holding on to faith. So that's kind of the, for me, the homiletic nub of that text.
Well, that's it. That's it. And you've identified it absolutely. With Rebecca and Isaac here, obviously, again, since we are, remember, in this series, one of the things that I'm certainly trying to remember and set up is that every story stands on its own. However, they also connect and they build. So as you've already pointed out, this is obviously setting up the family line, the continuing promise of the covenant, God's faithfulness, God acting. So that's a continuing theme of God with us. We're thinking about, what do we learn about God in these stories? What do we learn about God's relationship with God's people? Looking ahead a little bit, there are going to be challenges in this marriage and this family too. We're not going to cover a lot of them, but it's just like with Abraham and Sarah, there were challenges. There are going to be challenges in the next generation. But I'm particularly interested this time around in God's working through two outsiders here. The first being the servant, all right? A servant, a slave, a foreigner, not a particularly an inheritor of the promise here, not part of Abraham's family, although an honored servant. You know, you have to understand what you're talking about with the role of the servant there. But in the end of the day, he's a servant. He's an outsider. And so there's a little bit, this passage is so long, you don't have an awful lot of time to explore this, I don't think, with the story. But as you said, he asked for a sign, he was watching, and his statement of faith is, in verse 48, I bowed my head, I worshiped the Lord, I blessed the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who led me. So God's working right here in the midst of, quote, building a chosen people through an outsider. And we see that a lot in Hebrew scripture. The other outsider in the story is a woman, is Rebecca. Even though she is in the family and therefore, you know, connected in that way, we know the role of the woman was generally, there wasn't always a lot of voice for the women. And it's significant to me, the point you already raised up. In the middle of it, they look and they ask Rebecca, will you go with this man? Is this okay with you? And she's like, yeah, I will. And sort of in control of her own choice here. So on the part of the servant, on the part of the woman, we get themes of willing obedience. We get themes of openness to the working of God, openness to the future. There are themes of trust here, I believe, that you can pull out. Plus, as we've already mentioned, it's a great love story. And what a great ending there, sort of a love at first sight kind of thing. It's Hallmark is a great illustration of that. It's almost a modern romance. And I, too, like the line, when she looked up and saw Isaac, she slipped quickly from the camel. We could translate that, she jumped off. I mean, she, boom, she is right off of there. And who's that man? And so she veils herself and is meeting all of the, and what's interesting too is in this continuing story, it's a setup for even the next generation, because we get another story with their offspring, Jacob, when he comes back to the people to get a bride, and there's the whole veil thing's going to play in. These stories are just so well written.
Well, it's one of the, just talking about the stories, it's one of the places in which it becomes, I think, obvious that this is a part of I don't want to use the word tribe, but a culture, a group's oral Focus. Tradition of stories that are told over and over and over again, and they get rich detail that people almost look for. You know, when you got a little kid, I don't want to say they were a little kid, but you know, kids like oral stories, but if you change the story, they don't like it.
Oh yeah, that's not.
So it's a story everybody knows. That's not how it goes, Granddaddy.
Yeah, and everybody's sitting in the crowd punching. Just wait, here it comes. Just wait,
here it comes. Here it comes.
So I think, again, trying to draw it together. Now we've seen the God who hears, the God who acts. We've seen God in several different ways. Today I'm working with a God who cares about the details, a God who does understand what's going on, perhaps a God who is in the details. Certainly the servant believed that, right? God in the details, and a God who loves love, God who loves love. These are some of the ideas I'm playing around with bringing out in this continuing series. It's a great story.
So one, and briefly before we move on, the thing for preachers is, I remember Will Willimon used to say that people don't so much need to be told as to be reminded.
Yep.
And the value of, we sometimes get a little too engaged in novelty and creativity and a new thing. Oh, they've heard that before. And so in this tradition, as I say, it was the same story. The issue was, what use did the teller make of the story in the context in which they told it? That's the preacher's trick.
That's it.
Not a trick. That's your job, is tell the story well so it becomes a part of people's psyche. And then the old word, apply. But how does it fit within our context in this moment? What does this story help us to see about ourselves and God?
It's a great story, a lot of good details. But what we want to do, we don't want people just walking out saying, boy, that was a great story. We want there to be a place of connection, a place to see that in my life, and almost forming a new or a positive or renewing a memory myself of God's acting in these ways.
As we say in our preaching workshops, don't forget the most important point. What difference does it make?
What difference does it make?
Yep.
That's it.
So moving to the psalm, which is picked to go with this, and briefly we can just say about Psalm 45. It's a wedding psalm, probably written by the poet for a royal wedding. There's speculation about which wedding it was. There's no need to do that. I think one of the things to look at is verses 16 and 17. It's hard to tell whether this is the voice of the poet or the poet writing God's voice here. Mm-hmm. But it's a continuation of the covenant promise. Play in the place of ancestors, you, O king, shall have sons. That's an application there to the Genesis text. And you'll make them princes of the earth, and so all of this. So there's a wedding and a wedding psalm. It's, you know, like the wedding song for their wedding here. Come to Romans. Boy, I love this text. You have anything to say about Psalm? I'm sorry.
No. I was just going to point out you have the option with a clip from Song of Solomon, which is similarly set up here around the wedding. This is a great text. There's a setting by Randall Thompson, a composer. Maybe we'll go out with that today out of this text if you were looking for
it. We always benefit from your masters in church music.
Well, you know, there's a great piece by the composer Randall Thompson. And it uses the core of this Song of Solomon text. And especially since many of us are still in a virtual kind of thing, it would be a nice piece of music for an intro or a devotional thought or, you know, in support of the sermon. But it is also there functioning similarly to that psalm today.
Good. So well, the Romans text is one I delight in just because I love Lutheran paradox and dialectic and ambiguity about saint and sinner. This is a great text. I'm a saint and I'm a sinner at the same time. And it delves deeply into the psychology almost of moral action and ethics. And it gets into that because we can set it up and say, as my mama used to say, they tell me, this is how you should behave, and you should behave this way, and I know how to behave this way, and that's it. And if you don't, you're bad.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Paul lays this out in a totally interesting way that understands the difficulty of that.
Mm-hmm.
as Miss Sally Spoon at Hebron United Methodist Church in Caswell County, North Carolina, told me one night as I drove home with a load of nice women from Hebron from a revival where our choir had sung. She said, "I know I'm bad. What I want to know is what to do about it."
Yeah.
I know I've sinned, and it's a struggle. Mm. And the failure to reach perfection in this life is what Paul is addressing here.
Yep.
That great first line, "I do not understand my own actions, for I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate." Yeah. And that's the struggle throughout here. And one of the questions is, whether this is autobiographical with the I, if I do what I want, et cetera, et cetera. Or is it the I, the ego there, mm-hmm. is that like English, we would say, one does, trying to address the generic, and I'd say it's both.
Yeah.
I'd say rhetorically, Paul is not just talking about himself, he is inviting people into this conversation. About and people are sitting there nodding, saying, "Yeah, I know how that feels."
Yeah,
it's one of those things intentionally. So all of this, I is not just you could stand back and judge Paul. Paul is inviting us in to recognize how difficult it is, and his diagnosis is why is this, and he's with the prevailing of sin in this world. Mm-hmm. In most. A lot of places Paul talks about flesh and spirit. Here he talks a bit more about sin and the will and how difficult it is. One of the more famous writings of Martin Luther, based out of 723, captive to the law of sin. He talked about the freedom of the will. It's known as the bondage of the will. Where at what level does the Christian have free will?
Right.
Is the struggle there? Where do we, how far does our bondage to sin dwell? It's a long, long story. And it plays with that issue of our sinful nature versus what Christ has done for us. And what he's arguing against, I think, is this notion that I used to be bad, then I got saved, I got baptized, and now I'm good.
Yeah.
Because we all know it's not that way.
Correct.
And so he's exploring the nature of that. And I think that's a good sermon of thinking about who will rescue me from this body of death. That last line, Jesus Christ does.
Right.
And it's an ongoing work. That's one of the struggles to say. I remember, they used to, back in my Methodist days, one of the questions was, are you going on to perfection?
Yes.
And one of the things that, unless you delved into it deeply, Mark, John Wesley said, "I believe in moral perfection. I've never encountered it in this life." He said,
"I haven't found anybody that's figured it out." Yeah.
But I haven't found anybody who's made it. I mean, the whole discipline, the book is this effort to do that with a recognition of how difficult it is. And I just love that line of Wesley's, "I've never encountered anybody, but I have to believe it's possible." I think that's where Paul is struggling with, is saying we wish to be that way and our moral actions are bound there. Another way, both the Reformed tradition, early Reformed tradition, and some of the Lutheran tradition talked about it in terms of the third use of the law.
Right.
The first use, of course, was, to order human society and make us act better, no matter what our religion is,
right.
Basic laws. The second use, with theological use, had to do with confronting us with what Paul talks about. We just aren't good.
just,
the mirror. We look at ourselves in the light of the law and we admit we're not good. Mm-hmm. But the third use of the law comes in here is that it is helps a Christian develop ethics.
Yeah.
Not only do you say, "I don't measure up," but you begin to make an effort to measure up.
Right.
And it's a guide to the Christian, not a guide that says, "I have to do this or I'm not saved." It's not on that side. It's on the Lord Jesus Christ, who's delivered me through from this body of death. But then I structure my life after that to live a Christian life. That's what he's struggling with. The key is that the law, the Torah, can't fix us, but it can instruct us.
So. Can't fix us, but it can instruct us. That's pretty good. And a pretty good way to think about what these
things do. That's what Paul's getting at there with the law. The law cannot fix us. We can't do it well enough to get saved. But it can instruct us as we build a Christian life.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, that's part of that appeal at the very end, where it sounds almost like he's throwing up his hands. Wretched person I am, who can deliver me from this body of death? Whew. Thanks be to God through the living word, I don't know if living Torah is a good, adequate thing, but the living word through Jesus Christ, our Lord, that's ultimately where we come. Yeah. And so we engage with that word, and it is this process and a guiding, and we have a part to play in that too. So.
And when he uses law of sin, that's when you be most clearly that he's not talking about statutory law. You do this or not. It's what he's talking about, law, is an instruction. And there's the sin, almost like the old cartoon with the angel on one shoulder and the devil on the other. This is what he's talking about, the struggle. And he said, Jesus delivers us. All right, moving to Matthew chapter 11. Briefly, this text is people going to complain. That's it. People just going to complain. John is the funeral, and Jesus is the wedding, and nobody's happy either way, 16 through 19. That's what he's talking about, no matter what you do, they're not going to be pleased is the issue. And 19b, he introduces the Hebrew scripture word wisdom, Sophia, and there's a tie-in here that we don't explore enough in Christian theology of the Logos being identified somewhat with the wisdom. So Jesus is, in this text, Jesus is making that identification. That there is this sense in which that's who I am in this world, because partly what he's talking about is that it is divine wisdom that teaches us who Jesus is.
Right.
It's revealed.
Right.
That's what that whole business about the wisdom, you've revealed it to the little ones and not you've hidden it from the wise and all of that.
Yeah.
It really is. This is something you can't figure out. It's a revelatory moment. So the rest of this text kind of falls out 25 through 30 in three sections. And it's Jesus gives thanks in 25 and 26. That's a prayer of thank you to God for revelation that it has been revealed. 27 is a proclamation that of who Jesus is. All things have been handed over to me by my Father, and I'm the revelation of God and all that. And this, y'all know this, I am the one. And then we come to the invitation, come to me, all you that are weary and carrying heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. One of the unfortunate things is we have taken this to mean anything that's bothering us, that kind of. Mm-hmm. And in this context, he is talking about the onerous level of the law.
That's it.
The interpretation of the law that says you have to do all these things in order to please God. And he says, no, my burden. Notice he doesn't say there is no burden.
Correct.
There is no yoke. He says, my burden is easy, and my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. That is, take up a cross, and it's actually, in the long run, it's lighter and easier than the burden of the law, because I am with you through it.
Than carrying your own burden all throughout life. Yep. Absolutely. Man, there's good stuff. And Baba, thanks again for your careful thought and leading us through. We hope y'all hear or find or we spark something that you can grab a hold of and work with this week. I got to give props, as you were talking a little bit earlier, about asking somebody, well, how are you doing? Oh, well, I'm blessed. And that's one response. I got to give props to Brother Bob Beatty, an evangelist from many years ago, my youthful days as a song leader. And I worked in revival with Brother Bob. He was an active guy, played an accordion in the middle of his sermon. It was nothing. But Brother Bob would get up, and he hit this about every two or three sermons. He'd come along this line. I ask somebody, how you doing? And they say, oh, preacher, I'm just fine under the circumstances. He'd clap his hands and say, well, bless God, you oughtn't to be under the circumstances. You know the Lord. You oughtn't to be under the circumstances.
Exactly. Oughtn't to be under the circumstances. I do understand.
All right, Bubba. Not much left for us to do today other than to tell everybody bye.
Everybody bye.
Lectionary Lab Live is a Two Bubbas and a Bible production. Our opening theme is Safety Net, performed by Ryan. We go out today with The Things We Do for Love, written by Eric Stewart, Gary Goldman, and performed by 10cc.
Many broken hearts have fallen in the river. Too many lonely souls have drifted out to sea. You lay your bets and then you pay the price. The things we do for love.
The things we do for love.
Communication is the problem to the answer. Like walking in the rain and the snow when there's nowhere to go. When you're feeling like a part of you is dying and you're looking for the answer in her eyes. You think you're gonna break up, then she says she wants to make up. Walking in the rain and the snow when there's nowhere to go. When you're feeling like a part of you is dying and you're looking for the answer in her eyes. You think you're gonna break up, then she says she wants to make up.